the League of Devotees. He was 56 years old, attempting the impossible. How do you start a world movement when you have almost nothing? It requires a bold vision. Otherwise, how could he see opportunity in Jhansi's dirt streets, open sewers, and worldly medical students? He was invited there just to lecture. Even his talks they took as another dharma, accepting in the way they accepted all sadhus. They applauded politely, folded hands in namaskar, thanked him and went home, and he returned to Allahabad. Abai saw the bright side. There was something there, he thought. He took the chance and returned. His secret was constant devotion, glorification of the Lord. He had plans to start from Jhansi a League of Devotees. The whole world is waiting, Mr. Mitra, for spiritual revolution. He walked the streets day and night, talking with pious, worldly students, trying to budge them into action, to help him print books, to help him start training and sending out teachers to all parts of the world. Prabhupada spoke at Radha Memorial, thanking people, lecturing on the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and it was recorded in the newspaper, but with no mention of a world movement, of Krishna bhakti sweeping every nation. My mission is to train up 40 devotees, he wrote to Rupin, an old school friend, inviting him to be among the first. He asked the government to help. He placed a classified ad, candidates from any nationality to qualify themselves as real Brahmins. He went around Jhansi recruiting and duly entered the league with the registrar in Lucknow. This is how it started. By initiating a half-interested, part-time disciple, by taking up residence in a deserted temple, with no assurance of staying, and by writing day and night essays and books to be printed and translated into many languages, as studied by the qualified Brahmins of any nationality. Planning, even before he had anything, and meeting with opposition, the silent landlord soon appeared, reneging his charity and demanding 5,000 rupees. Then Abai, who had no local financial support, learned one day that his pharmacy in Allahabad had been plundered. So he returned to Calcutta to earn more money to keep afloat the worldwide League of Devotees. Last family scene, Calcutta. He invites his wife and son to come and join him in Gita talks. But the son looks back, sullen, hands behind, and the wife sits at tea. He asked her to choose between me or tea. She thought he was joking. Well, I will have to give up my husband then. Of course, it wasn't only tea, it was the force of Krishna consciousness. He had to earn some money for the League of Devotees, but he was plunged again into family duties. After 36 years, unbearable. Rent, bills, daughters to marry, where would it ever end? He had to choose between the league and the home. The tea-taking, and then her selling his Bhagavatam in exchange for biscuits, the final stroke. When he left, they didn't know he was never coming back. The time is up. Never mind whether daughters are married. God will take care. Now I am dead. Whatever you like, you do. For a day or two he chanted japa with godbrothers south of Calcutta, getting his bearings, praying to Krishna. Yes, he had done the right thing. Chanting the holy name, loosed from family and income, on his own, a spiritual dependent on his guru's order. Let me go now, he thought, back to Jhansi. That little field awaited, and he had the vision to work it, expand it, by Krishna's grace, into a glorious, formidable mission, something practical, a movement to engage us all in pure devotional service. Lost Jhansi. Women were plotting to take away the building of the League of Devotees. Make it a ladies' social club, they said. A more important cause than Abai's. Suryamukhi asked him to vacate. but he refused. She went behind his back with support from Mrs. Munshi, the governor's wife. The landlord agreed, "Please get out. The ladies want to use it to uplift themselves." "Try to understand," Abai wrote Mrs. Munshi. "The ladies' club is a limited designation. My work is for everyone's upliftment. Even one of low birth can take shelter of the Supreme Lord." It was a peaceful compound near Antia Pond, shady orchards, the temple a stout little palace. The league had begun with a well-attended ceremony. The League of Devotees, painted 6 feet high on the outer wall. But the governor's wife insisted. He could fight her in court, said lawyer friends, but he thought, "I have left home, and now I should take up litigation?" It wasn't meant to be. The league, yes. Jhansi, no. Krishna had some other plan. The loss was to Jhansi, and to those who drove him out. Carrying his large deity of Lord Chaitanya, he moved to Mathura, and then, alone, to Delhi. New Delhi in the 1950s. "These were very difficult years," he said, "but the sufferings were all assets. Let us try to see him by the scale of the Mahabhagavat, and also by the human-like scale." He went without food or residence, when he could have been comfortably at home or residing in godbrother's mutt. But he wanted to try, more ambitious than his godbrothers, and certainly he wanted to be free of the home. He was alone in New Delhi, trying to make heard the message of Krishna, a far cry from Hastinapur, the Delhi of thousands of years past, when Lord Krishna and the Pandavas ruled in pure goodness, protecting the citizens and animals from attack. Now it was independent India, filling up with ruffians and cheap cinemas, and politicians determined to forget the best of their own culture, determined to ape the hedonism of the West. And on these streets he was trying to be heard. He was in New Delhi because a sannyasi godbrother asked him to edit Sajana Tosani. But when he arrived at the mat, there was no preaching but much quarreling, no typewriter, and no promise of one, no money even for a dhoti, but a letter, "Please manage the whole thing." Since he could not afford to produce his BTG, he agreed to work at Sajana Tosi. But it should be like Illustrated Weekly, widely read and well done, increase the circulation, improve the editorial. But his godbrother wanted it small, no more than 500 copies a month. And when Abai persisted, color photos and high-quality paper, they wrote him a flowery letter dismissing him. "You are a favorite Vaishnava with lofty plans, and we cannot keep up with you, so go on your own." He wanted to start a spiritual movement, so he went to the wealthy with his writing and plans to train 40 men to send to foreign countries. They heard him out in their law offices, their gentlemen's chambers, impressed by his simple, grave demeanor and his scholarship and saintly purpose, but they could not help except to give him 5 rupees to drag on. Another ad, "Study the spiritual secret of Bhagavad Gita at home by correspondence and be a strong man." Krishna was maintaining him with little, like a sannyasi mendicant. If he had wanted only maintenance, he could have lived at a beggar's temple and chanted Hare Krishna alone. But he wanted to preach with the big madranga. He waited no longer. Even before there was money for rent or food or to replace torn clothes, he went to a printer with a manuscript to revive back to Godhead. The printer, Kumar Jain, judged him by the human scale, since he himself was an ordinary man. But he couldn't help but see extreme dedication to the spiritual cause. Why else would this pauper come early in the morning to look at the printing proofs, walking in the cold without a coat, no fare for rickshaw, no money for breakfast? Why publish at all when you have no money? To Mr. Jain, it made no sense, but he could understand back to Godhead is the work of pure devotion. This customer wants to start a movement, wants the people to turn to Krishna, doesn't care anything for himself, has no other lower motivation. He is a very rare soul, and yet he is a humble, gregarious person, more a friend than a poor customer, sitting to talk about God and how he is the answer to life's degradation. Out on Sankirtan. He is the origin and model for all book distributors going out to meet conditioned souls, approaching them without knowing whether they will be rude, violent, cold, or receptive. As he was going door to door, a homeowner shouted from his second floor veranda, "Go away! We don't want you here!" He carried a stack of newspapers and sometimes went to the tea stalls, sat at the table with tea drinkers, kindly offering them his paper. They usually had no time for him. Too busy paying illusion's toll, sipping tea, dazed by Maya, on the go, making a living, unconcerned about Krishna and sadhus. But they would look up in an offhand way at A.C. Bhaktivedanta and sometimes took a copy of his unusual tabloid with headlines, "Sufferings of Humanity." Prabhupada was kind to them, as Prahlad was kind to his demon schoolmates. "Please take to Krishna consciousness," he pleaded. Mostly they replied, "No time." Despite long hours of refusals, walking in the passionate Delhi thoroughfares, pausing to catch someone in the rushing throngs of passers-by, Abhay was always feeling Brahma-Bhuta, spiritual happiness. He prayed to his Guru Maharaj, knowing he was pleasing him. He tasted the supreme bliss. He was walking, and a cow gored him. In India, even in the city, cows come and go, but this one, when she saw him, lunged forward and put her horn in his side, knocking him down. "Why is this?" he thought. "I have taken to renounced life to preach, so why this reverse has come to knock me down?" But such things were assets, he later said, and he understood this as Krishna's mercy. Reeling in the 112-degree heat, he tried to sell BTG, even in the oven atmosphere of midday Delhi. A person had recently died from the heat, but Abhay was out distributing BTGs despite the heat. As he reeled, a man passing by in a car noticed and stopped and took him to a doctor. Unremitting beyond body and intense weather, Abhay paid it little mind, although warned. He went on preaching. He sent copies of Back to Godhead to the people of the West with a letter. "You have seen so much wealth, but peace is not within your control." He sent copies to the President of India. "Don't think of me as a madman when I say I shall go back to Godhead. It is quite possible for every one and all of us." At the post office, an Arya Samajist clerk criticized, "What is the use of propagating Godhead?" The copies each contained the truths of Vedic sages and Prabhupada's own experience from preaching on the streets and meeting all varieties of speculators. One man saw the title and challenged, "Where is Godhead? Can you show me God?" Next issue, an article appeared with Abhay's response, "Seeing God is not so cheap." 1,000 copies a month, 8 consecutive issues by June of 56, all written and delivered by his own hands. India was so fallen. Thousands welcomed Lord Mountbatten at the Delhi airport, likewise the Shah of Iran, and Secretary of State Dulles, honored guests to Delhi. The Indians cheered, not caring for their own Vishnu Jana, Prabhupada, not knowing, not caring, not heeding. In the land of Lord Krishna and Lord Rama, true religion was ignored in favor of the flitting fireflies of Maya. Prabhupada had come to expect it. Mandak samanda matayo. He went on and went out, searching for one in a million. And yet, everyone he met was blessed by his contact. Just a glance or a touch of his journal could save them from the greatest fear. Such is the potency of the Maha Bhagavata's preaching. Living in Vrindavan. He went to Vrindavan and imbibed the special quality there. From his rooftop at Vamsi Gopal Mandir, on the edge of the town of temples, close by the river Jamuna, he felt great ecstasy remembering Krishna. Why does a devotee go to Vrindavan? Ask, why does a bird like the sky, or a fish the water? For Prabhupada it was inspiration and shelter. He came to write. He would commute to Delhi to walk the city streets with PTG, but now with his residence in the Dham. We speak of his plans, but they were more like attempts to serve and depend on Krishna. In all activities and for the results, just depend on me. There were daily attempts and larger hopes, as yet unfulfilled. In Delhi, he tried collecting enough funds to produce and sell the next fortnightly issue. In Vrindavan, he bought charcoal for cooking, and he spent for postage to send missives around the world, urging scholars and leaders to take part in the great attempt. He lacked money to send magazines to all the men and countries on his list. Soon he was traveling in and out of Vrindavan, to Bombay, then Kanpur, then Bombay again. But he couldn't raise financial support. People liked him and mostly gave ear, but money was another thing. They also needed money. After 12 consecutive issues, in 56, he stopped producing Back to Godhead. He had barely enough money to travel to Delhi. Thus went the daily plans. Meanwhile, the greater plans swelled and grew surer within him. He felt he must go to the West. His countrymen were too intent on politics, deliberately putting aside the Vedas. Westerners, he thought, would be more inclined. Only due to lack of money he had to wait, but he took it as Krishna's arrangement. He tried the League of Devotees again, this time from Vamsi Gopalji, but his one disciple was inclined elsewhere. Prabhupada was more than 60 years, with no money coming, yet he wrote and hoped while entering into his intimate relationship with Vrindavan. One day, while sitting alone, getting many realizations, he wrote a Bengali poem, Vrindavan Bhajan. I have my wife, sons, daughters, grandsons, everything, but I have no money, so they are a fruitless glory. Why should a sadhu hanker for money and travel? Shouldn't he stay in Vrindavan, protecting himself from wealth and women, and never cross over the ocean? Yes, if he can do it, staying alone, without cheating, but if he has in his heart orders and desires of the previous acharyas to save the wretched people in Maya, those outside the holy places, those outside all hope and scope of redemption by the Vedic process, if he has such a big heart, then he may hanker for money, to go to them. Then his hankering is lalasmayi, and he will cry tears, hoping to be allowed to reach the fallen souls. Taking sannyas. His spiritual master came in a dream again, this time in Vrindavan. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati gestured again and said the same thing, come with me, take sannyas. His guru was calling to him. A dream of guru is not ordinary, not to be taken lightly. He appeared and spoke, and Abai took it seriously, but he was cautious. Why take sannyas? Before he had asked himself why, and he hadn't concluded with an impelling reason. Now he did. Sannyas would be good for his purpose of traveling, writing books, and leaving India to preach. That was what sannyas was for, not for advertising oneself as ascetic. not acquiring cheap praise, like the cheating sannyasis who distort the Vedic way. So Prabhupada was cautious. He approached a godbrother who discouraged him. "First you join our party." Another made no condition, but only insisted, "Bhaktivedanta Prabhu, you must do it." Prabhupada thought, "Through the voice of this godbrother is coming my master, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. He wants me to do it. It will enable me to go and make a league of devotees somewhere." So he went to Keshava Maharaja's mat, and another man, 99 years old, also took sannyas that day. But Prabhupada's sannyas was different. He was not getting ready to leave this world, but to go into it as Krishna's representative. His sannyas was arranged by the Lord for getting him ready to go. It was like his learning madranga, his being dissolved of business interests, like his leaving wife and family, his purity and bravery, his immunity to greed and doubt, his determination, all these qualities and many more he would need for venturing forth at such a late age. Venturing forth, he has yet no money. It is something like a dream. Sannyasis of Gaudiya Math have already gone to England and returned, saying, "It was impossible. It is something like a dream only." Starting the Bhagavatam. The sparking incidents were external. An army captain and a librarian said books were more permanent than newspapers, so Bhaktivedanta Swami should write books. But there were other deeper reasons. For a headline to one prospectus Bhaktivedanta Swami had printed, "Anartha Upashamam Sakshat," the miseries of the living being, which are superfluous to him, can be remedied by Bhakti Yoga, but no one knows it. Therefore, Srila Vyasadeva, out of his compassion, has compiled this Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is Krishna himself after his departure from the earth. Lord Chaitanya called it the spotless Purana and stressed reading it, as did Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. For Prabhupada to translate the Bhagavatam was as natural as his going to Vrindavan and chanting Hare Krishna. It was the work par excellence for a Vaishnava world preacher. A project without end, not something to whip up for carrying and showing when he went abroad. It was a specific calling. Whenever and wherever he might go, this would be his life's work. Begun in Vrindavan just after taking sannyas. As Lord Krishna had Vyasa wait until his mature stage before compiling Srimad Bhagavatam, so he perfectly prepared his divine grace to begin the Bhaktivedanta purports on time at 64 years of age. And as Vyasa worked from a vision, so did Srila Prabhupada. Vyasa saw the Lord and his various energies. Maya was unable to stand before him. And Vyasa saw the sufferings of the jivas as well as their remedy, Bhakti Yoga. Within Srila Prabhupada, the vision of the remedy through the Sankirtan of Lord Chaitanya had grown to the point where he knew he must carry it out, going to the wildest lands of Maya's realm to personally lead the chanting. He saw the sufferings of the jivas from within his mind and heart, and with his own eyes over decades in India, he saw their subjugation through war and partition. And he knew the suffering was worldwide. Maya could not stand before the Lord, but before the demons and conditioned fools, she was riding triumphantly, defeating them. And Prabhupada saw himself as the instrument of the past acharyas, easing the jivas from Maya's grip by offering the light of the Bhagavatam, the life full of grace as wrought by Chaitanya and as desired by Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. Sometimes Prabhupada dreamed that he was already in New York, and so he prayed to deliver the Westerners. the calling. He moved into Radha Damodar Temple, a room 5 feet by 17 with a view from the kitchen through cement latticework of Rupa Goswami's samadhi. Rising at 1 a.m., while spiritually bright stars illumined the dark Vrindavan sky, he wrote on Bhagavatam. The blessed purports came from his intelligent transcendental labors. His own English he apologized for, although it was perfectly clear. The inmates in the house of fire would know he was calling them out. By electric, or often by candlelight, month after month, in weather from hot to cold, in his new ancient room, he composed the purports on a small manual typewriter, on the backs of Soviet propaganda sheets, or whatever paper he could find. He was known locally as the sadhu who was always writing and who regularly walks chanting Hare Krishna through the bazaars on simple errands, but usually in his little room typing or cooking or chanting outside by Rupa Goswami's samadhi. His body is a golden hue, as when he was a child, his eyes as clear as a child's, his heart purer than a child's, his hands aristocratic, figured with the vein lines, and his hair growing gray, cut short, and shaved monthly, leaving Sikha, this Vaishnava sannyasi who was always writing. He is sweet to the few who come by and converse with him on the veranda in the evening when he takes off his reading glasses. He patiently hears others and discusses his own desires to spread Krishna consciousness. He doesn't talk nonsense. He goes away here and there, but usually to Delhi, to the printers, and then he comes back by Tunga, back to his room, where you can hear the typing again as he methodically collects the pages. He says he is writing the Bhagavatam for English readers and will publish it and one day go to the people there in America and present it along with Harinam. He used to do medical business in Allahabad and Calcutta, and he had a family, but that is all gone. And he is a Vrindavan sannyasi, talking and writing and worshipping Krishna, looking up from his simple prasadam with intent private gaze into the courtyard to the samadhi of Rupa and Jiva. He is a disciple of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, but has nothing to do with God-brothers' disputes. He writes and chants and tries to publish in the true Vrindavan spirit. Rupa Goswami lived there, and Jiva. All 6 Goswamis gathered and spoke Krishna Leela, an honored prasadam, sitting on the stone floor, eating from leaves, writing on other leaves, chanting on tulsi beads, dancing on the banks of the Jamuna. The literature they left is a vast treasure house in Sanskrit, and Prabhupada is writing in their footsteps. For a worldwide English-speaking people, whom he has not yet met, but he is creating books for them, inspired by the 6 Goswamis and his spiritual master. It is they who are blessing him to live in Vrindavan as well as to leave Vrindavan and to ignite the world with bhakti. They are sending him forth. He lives in their place and he prepares to leave with their permission. He loves their abode and the simple renounced life, but he is unhappy at the unhappiness of others. He will go out to fulfill a duty into hell with Vrindavan's message. Printing 3 volumes. He went to Delhi for printing up and down the streets. A book once written cries to be printed. In Delhi, Chandni Chowk is the place. If a sadhu is not afraid of crowds and mixing with materialists for the sake of glorifying Krishna. Hitsaran Sharma suggested he try Hanuman Podar. Using almost all his money, Prabhupada went to see him. A donation, enough to start printing. Up and down the street, carrying the printed sheets through crowded chaos of Chowri Bazaar, the paper-selling capital of India. He wrote in a room in a tenement building at Chippewada in Old Delhi, and went out from that noisy place into the noisy, dirty streets where people spat pan and smoked and pushed and shoved and bought and stole. And he was among them as saintly as Vrindavan. He was peaceful in Krishna thought, yet all intent on business. Get the Bhagavatams printed. That was everything. And he was alone. It is a practical thing to physically manifest the desires of the acharyas. It takes tedious work, material dealing with a spiritual eye, back labor, paper, ink, hammers, saws, glue, patience, and sometimes anger. You have wasted my whole day, Sharmaji. You said it would be ready. Is this the same person who wrote during quiet, moonlit hours in the crude temple cell? Yes, the same Prabhupada, intent on printing what he had been inspired to write. Because Krishna is God, because the printed word is worthy, because the desire and inspiration were tangible, and the sufferings of the jivas were not mere abstractions, therefore he comes to Chowri Bazaar, reads the galleys, two times, three times, looking for mistakes, and he prints anyway, even if he can't catch them all. And sometimes he is tired. One tells me a Nitya Siddha cannot be tired, and we shouldn't say that he reeled in the streets from heat stroke, shouldn't say he displayed impatience or anger with the printers. But they don't know. These are also transcendental glories. He is not an ordinary man, therefore he goes to Chowri Bazaar only on Krishna's business. And he prints the Bhagavatam and collects for that only, lives and breathes and works, and gets tired and impatient, and reels in the streets, falls down gored to advance the cause of Krishna consciousness. They don't know the mind of the Acharya, nor do I, but we hear from him. So, even though we are not in the Himalayas, even though we talk of business, even though we deal in rupees and pice, still, simply because we are 100% servants of the Lord and are engaged in the service of broadcasting the message of His glories, certainly we shall transcend and get through the invincible impasse of Maya and reach the effulgent kingdom of God to render Him face to face eternal service in full bliss and knowledge. Finally going. Mr. Agarwal of Mathura only casually mentioned he could get Prabhupada's sponsorship in America through his son, and Prabhupada only casually took him up on it. In Butler, Pennsylvania, Mr. Agarwal's son Gopal only casually did the needful, yet that was the way of Krishna. After that, you moved intent as an arrow. You went to Mrs. Murarji for travel fare, and she said, yes, but only after you insisted that you would not die en route, as her officers feared. So she gave you fare, a room on the old steamer going west. But the P form was a problem. The agent said no, because your patron was a private person, not an institution. So it seemed after so much effort, you would be blocked by this one last bureaucratic snarl, and you wouldn't be able to come to us. Although you so much wanted to break out, since India was stifling and unreceptive, but at this last bureaucratic door, you were blocked by the Bank and Government of India. They should have been glad to send you as their ambassador, but they were cripple-minded. So you spoke up for yourself. No, this is not right. Give my file to your superior. The clerk complied, and his officer came out to where you sat in a Bombay government waiting room and said, Swamiji, don't worry. I have passed your case. That, too, was Krishna. After that, everything else was ready. Scindia's agent bought you some clothes. You packed a bag of dry cereal and took an umbrella. You printed a flyer, India's message of goodwill, and you went to Calcutta, rode in a taxi down to the dock, and walked up the gangway carrying a suitcase, your books arriving separately. Now, only the ocean's storms separated you from us. On our side, the hour was very late, but not too late. No one was waiting for you in exactly the form you were coming, yet we were aching for you nonetheless, as parched land awaits rain, as a lost child awaits the mother, as a lonely lover awaits the beloved, as the soul aches for God. The dumb tongues stuck, unable to utter Krishna. The blind groped. The mad went madder, incurring reactions. And every moment more jivas fell off the cliff of human life down into the abyss of Tamoguna. Inching from the weathered pier, the black-hulled Jaladuta moved toward the seas, bearing him to America. By the law of the Almighty, the ship floated in water. By His will only, the clouds in the skies moved. Out of fear of Him, the planets were spinning in tremendous orbits. And by His inscrutable sweet will, the pure devotee was coming to rescue the damned.
Hare 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 the lawn. Ah!